Accession number 13668, Reel 1.
Mr. Adams, Reel 1. How did you come to join the parachute regiment, please?
I was commissioned in England in towards the end of 1941, September 41. And I was actually posted to the South Staffordshire Regiment. And I joined the 1st 6th Battalion, which was in the 59th Division, and fortuitously was stationed up in Northumberland, which was my home county, because basically I'm a Geordie. But just about that time, it was decided that the Indian Army needed expansion. Presumably they had the possibilities of war with Japan. And I was volunteered, I quote, volunteered. I didn't actually volunteer. On the basis of last in, first out, with several other newly commissioned officers. And to my surprise, I found myself on the SS RMS Strathallan, the pride of the P&O, in the Clyde, waiting for the convoy to establish. When the day before we left for India, Pearl Harbor occurred. So after a two-month trip out to India, I found myself at the Indian Military Academy in Dehradun, doing a transfer course for the Indian Army. This was largely concerned with learning to speak Urdu, and also how to fight on the Northwest Frontier. And we were told that those who got top marks in Urdu would get pride of choice and place and an extra few days leave if we did well in our Urdu exam. With a certain means, I managed to pass out fairly high, got my first choice, which actually was to join King Edward's own 2nd Gurkha Rifles, which were usually regarded as the best of the Gurkha regiments. But somewhere along the line, they one weekend they'd come and ask for volunteers for parachuting, and I said, well, put my name down. And to cut a long story short, Mickey Thomas came up and interviewed us. I suddenly, when I was on leave in Lahore, I still got the telegram, actually, saying, previous posting cancelled, report 151, British Parachute Battalion, Delhi. So I found myself back in the British Army. And that was that. I was joined them in, when would it be, about February, March 42, I think, and stayed with them, until Arnhem. Trained, I think I must have been the first, me and Michael Pitt. We were about the last officers to actually do a parachute course. I did one jump in on it in Delhi, which was rather unfortunate because the other officer in the stick who was new was killed. And my platoon sergeant had been killed, I'd seen him killed, on a demonstration jump the day before. That was then when they cancelled all further dropping and they moved up to Rawalpindi, where, funnily enough, our first jump, we were five sergeants, myself, Michael Pitt, and an RSM who'd just come to replace our RSM, who was time expired, having done his 6 years in India. You went back on Python, I think it was called, something like that, back to England. Our first jump, we were pushed forward 24 hours, was actually, the Gurkhas will never admit this, to a confidence jump to show to some Gurkhas who were up there who had refused to jump because they said that the chutes were being sabotaged, the Saabs will jump. The RSM, as I said, refused, went back to his unit. The rest of us completed our parachute training in Chiklala and then went back to India, Delhi. But you can understand parachuting was I seldom volunteered for a jump after that.
Now, jumping ahead back in England,
yeah.
Can you tell me about the preparations for your first operation?
You mean, which one are you talking about? Are you talking
what was your first operation?
Well, the first operation, of course, was Italy. We landed. We were all the battalion was on the USS Boise, which was part of a fast convoy of cruisers. The Boise was the United States. The others, one of them was, for example, the Penelope. Took off from I think it was Bizerta, landed at Taranto just as the Italian fleet was coming out. And it was, I was then, incidentally, in B Company. And B Company was commanded by Hector Montgomery because Dan Weber had gone back to India to the staff college. We had to, our brigade was had to support the... or at least make safe Taranto and as a port. And that night, of course, was the night when the Welsh battalion from the 2nd Para Brigade, who were also concerned, were blown up in the harbour with heavy casualties. Anyway, we went on and... it was in, we had a nice little action there when Blanco Clegg was able with the great elan.
This is Blanco Clegg, we should say.
Blanco Clegg, yes. To operate his mortars as a battery. It was a tremendous success. Particularly as the people we were up against, I believe, were the 1st Parachute Regiment of the Germans. And we took the position with minimum casualties. I think it was 2 killed and half a dozen injured or so. And that was the classic mortar action upon which subsequently the... powers that be in the UK used as a training example. Then, of course, in December, we were brought back to the UK. And as you probably know, the division was briefed fully or partially for about anything up to 8 operations before we actually took off and went to Arnhem.
How frustrating was that for morale?
Very, very frustrating indeed. I don't think it adversely affected our morale. It was just irritating and annoying. And I think it also put pressure on senior officers to sort of keep the spirits up, and because there we were, we wanted to be in And so come September, of course, we were all anxious to get there before the war ended.
Can you tell me about the actual preparations for Arnhem, please?
Well, the preparations, I mean, it wasn't the first operation we'd been briefed for. We'd been briefed for three or four before, and usually, as the saying went then, if we had landed, they'd advance so quickly. The only thing we could have dropped with was collecting tins for the Airborne Security Fund. And but the preparations, so far as I was concerned, the big concern, by this time I'd moved to support company and I was in charge of the mortar platoon, and Blanco Clegg was second in command of the company, and Tom Wainwright commanded it. My main concern was that for some reason which I cannot understand, the powers that be in the battalion had decided that the mortars were to be dropped on the man. And now, as far as I know, no other battalion attempted to do this. The problem, generally speaking, was with the thing the mortar goes up.
The tube.
Not the tube. No, that didn't cause any problem at all. It was the the problem, so far as I was concerned, was carrying the bipod. This couldn't fit comfortably in the sack we carried. These big kit bags we carried on our leg and let down after we came out of the plane, we let it down on a lead and it dangled below us. Because with the rest of the equipment, including mortar bombs and also ammunition and goodness knows what else, it was too heavy. You couldn't let it down hand over hand. It had to go down like that. And the result was that very often it actually broke the whole kit bag up and the contents fell out, or the rope snapped, or it got damaged on the ground. And therefore, I didn't mind so much men dropping with bombs in the kit bag, or the base plate, which was nice and small, or even the barrel. Although that was rather high and could, on occasion, knock the unfortunate Mortimer's teeth out. It was carrying the bipod. And it was laid down that I must do it. It would affect all the loading tables and everything else if it wasn't. To cut a long story short, instead of having seven mortars landed at Arnhem, I had four. Because three bipods had been lost or irreparably damaged. So not only did that cut down the supporting fire of the battalion almost half, but when you consider that one of the two planes for the Vickers Machine Gun Company, which was also in support company, was shot down in flames with everybody lost. You probably heard of that from Jeff Noble. Our supporting fire for the battalion was cut by half when we landed. Not that that would necessarily have caused an awful lot of undue problems, as it turned out, afterwards, because of two things. One, from my experience, most of the fighting I was involved in was in a heavily wooded area, which would have very considerably restricted the use of mortars anyway. And secondly, the And this is something which I only had confirmed within the last 2 years. There was something about the terrain at Arnhem which made wireless communication and communication by landline almost impossible. So I found that normally you establish an OP and your link back to the mortar position was by landline. Didn't work. Walkie-talkies didn't work. Now, I happened to mention this 2 years ago when I was, or 18 months ago, when I was out at Arnhem in connection with this annual walk of the children. And they said, oh, yes, it's renowned, this particular area of Holland, for bad communication. And I mentioned it again to Shan Hackett this year. And he said, yes, that is so. Now, this is an interesting thing which I haven't seen in any report, insofar as I was never anyway in a position to fire or use my mortars in a traditional way. It didn't affect what happened afterwards. But it is a very interesting fact, so far as I'm concerned anyway, that there was this dreadful lapse through nobody's fault in communication, either on landline or by walkie-talkie. I don't think it affected the more sophisticated, higher powered sets which would communicate between, say, a foo of the artillery and his guns, and or higher echelons than companies and platoons. We finished up. It would be on our second day. Suddenly told to break off. We were brought back through this under the railway line, where the route had been obstructed by a falling container, which had smashed through the railway line and made it impossible for us to get our jeeps to the south of the railway line, and so to speak, into the airborne position, which was being at Oosterbeek, which was south of the railway line. We were then told to, we had to march back to Wolfheser, which was about 2 miles, 2 to 3 miles back along the way we'd come, but on the south side of the railway embankment. And there we were told to dig in, and there seemed to me at that stage to be a lack of communication or whatever it was, I don't know. But I found myself there with without my mortars, because of course they'd had to take the northern route with the mortars on the jeeps and trailers, an assorted bunch of men with me. Not only the men from the mortar platoon, but the men from, there were one or two Poles who'd landed and seemed to be a bit lost, and there were people from other battalions, and quite a sort of mishmash. That night at about 11 or 12 o'clock, I and my company commander, Tom Wainwright, were together with the remnants or my platoon and all these odds and bods. And we had been joined by another officer from our battalion called Matthews, who I think was in charge of, at that particular time, was in charge of the glider-borne element of the battalion. In other words, there's bits and pieces such as jeeps, which came in later by glider. And we decided that we were in a completely and utterly indefensible position where we were. It was fairly heavily wooded. We had no liaison with anybody else. And we decided that we should try and get to Oosterbeek, which, of course, is where the big perimeter was naturally formed. So we decided that the best thing for us to do was to wait until things had quietened down a bit and then proceed to withdraw and make our way to the perimeter at Oosterbeek. This we did about midnight, having secured ourselves and anything that rattled and put all the socks over boots and all that sort of business. I suppose there were about 80 or 90 of us. And Tom Wainwright and I led the way, and Theo Matthews took up the rear. And we got on this road and we started down it in the direction of Oosterbeek. And we were challenged. It sounded like Verdun, but knowing that there are quite a few Poles had been dropped around about us, we thought we'd try and just say, see his friend and see what happened, you see. And there was another more urgent Verdun, and there was no doubt about that one at all. Tom, who's with me, broke to the right of the road. We were on the left-hand side of the road, to the where there were houses. He broke to the trees on the right-hand side, and I automatically followed him. But unfortunately, or fortunately, whichever way you look at it, nobody followed us. The next thing, everything was a blaze of light, and there was fire coming up the road and down the road, and we spent the rest of the time that night trying to get back across to the other side of the road, but we couldn't.
Were many hit in the initial outburst of fire?
I don't know. Honestly, I doubt it in that initial burst, because it was it happened so quick you don't think. You immediately, when it happens, you obviously you take cover of some sort or another. Tom had broken to the right across the road, and I had just followed him. But nobody followed us. And we spent the rest of the night trying to get back, but it was like Piccadilly Circus, with the lights and one thing and another. So come morning, we found ourselves in this wood, surrounded literally by Germans. And so we lay and covered ourselves with grass, leaves. It was approaching autumn, so I suppose there are a lot of leaves about. And that was it. There was a hell of a battle going on, and all the day. We, I mean, it. We were surrounded by Germans. How the hell they didn't see us, God alone knows. Just one of those things. And from that moment on, we were, I think the term is evaders. And after a few days, trying to get back, we had to lie up during the day for obvious reasons, and then eventually, after a few days, we found ourselves in a greenhouse. And in this greenhouse, there was what had been, I imagine, a sunken tank for water or something, which was as good a place as any to lie up during the daytime. And we were discovered by a couple of Dutch boys who said that, who told us that there were now no longer any British forces north of the river. Actually, they were a bit premature because subsequently, we came to the conclusion that our forces actually withdrew the night of that morning when we were discovered. But that being the case, we decided that we should try and, because of the, get out of this concentration of enemy troops and make our way to the sort of agricultural area to the west. And we'd settled on a farm called Kwada Oort. And cut a long story short, we made it to Kwada Oort, attracted the farmer's attention, who fed us and hid us in a sort of swine shelter for the next few days. We were then picked up by a couple of Dutch boys who produced wheelbarrows with red crosses, Red Cross flags over them, put on civilian clothes over our uniforms, deposited our guns and everything in the wheelbarrows. We then had to walk these wheelbarrows through a German motorized infantry battalion which were resting in the woods. I've never felt more exposed in my life, coupled with the fact that I was very, very conscious of our army boots, which... Just me and Tom Wainwright. Just the pair of us. Nobody had followed us on that unfortunate night, or fortunate as far as we were concerned. We were then picked up. We left our wheelbarrows by the railway, having